everyone. So, of course, everyone here is committed to helping the homeless and developments, but how can we make sure the message gets through? How can we train others to develop the same passion, interests and high standards, which is what we all are aiming for and need, and to be recognised and to have those standards recognised? So hopefully we're going to hear this afternoon Suzanne, who's come from Durham, to tell us about teaching the medical students, and then Chris doing the postgrad teaching down in Brighton. So should be good. So as you've heard, they're each going to speak and then we'll do questions at the end.
Right, so I move around a bit, so just hopefully you can keep up with me a bit. So I'm Suzanne Newbrook. I am program manager of something called the Difficult and Deprived Areas Program at Durham University. I always feel a bit of an imposter in academia. That is not hugely my background. I'm a clinician by background, I'm a teacher by background, and I'm a program manager by background. So you wouldn't guess it from my accent, but I grew up in a very poor neighborhood in the southeast of London, towards Bermondsey. Spent most of my professional career in America, and I joined the university in 2014. And this is kind of the baby I was given. I have other jobs now, but this was the thing I was given to start off with, so it's very close to my heart. So I'm not going to go on about this too much. You've had some much better speakers talking about this, but clearly we're aware that there are growing inequities. It's causing increased strain on our acute care services. With these socially excluded populations, we know that a lot of the care needs to be undertaken in primary care, community care, public health sectors. There's a lot of great innovative models. I'm looking at Tim, who I'll talk to in a minute. We'll be coming and spend time with Pathways every year with my student group. There's some fantastic things going on. There's specialist GP practices that work with homelessness, substance abuse. My students get to work with some of those folks. But there's all these models coming up, but are we making sure that our healthcare practitioners of the future are getting the adequate training? There's not a lot of great training around this in not just medical school, which is what I'm gonna be talking about, but in other places as well. And the HEIs, the Higher Education Institutes, really have a responsibility to kind of step up to the plate and make sure that those needs are being met. A little bit of background, the Lancet report was printed in 2010. That's where some international academic leaders and healthcare professionals got together and assessed health education. And they found several things. They found out that, not surprisingly, a lot of the healthcare professionals were overstrained, but a lot of them also felt that they were inadequately prepared to care for those socially excluded populations. So they proposed, let's get out our students in environments where they can see the big picture, not where they're just in these individual silos of nurses and pharmacists and medical students, that they're predominantly, for our medical students, trained in secondary care and acute care hospital trust. Let's get them out in the community, and I think it's very interesting in this country, when they say community, that often means GP practices. In America, that doesn't mean the same thing. I want my students to be with GPs and in the community. Our GPs need to be working with the community and with the public health. Hopefully GPs are very much more engaged in community, but I see that as two separate things. We want to make sure that these students are exposed to these fantastic models that are out there, that they get to work in multidisciplinary teams, and that they get to see how they work together, what are the resources, particularly in the communities where they hope to work. We want to make sure that we train them in non-traditional, and by that I mean for medical students, that is typically secondary. We want to train them in other settings as well. And that there should be sort of core competencies amongst them, amongst the HCPs. Now this, at this point, was talking more about encompassing social determinants of care. But I'm going to go on to say some other core competencies that have been recommended since. So this is a nod. Sir Michael Mom is going to be here later. I'm really excited. So, you know, clearly social determinants, we understand how much that relates to healthcare. We understand the impact. And Michael Mom was commissioned by the World Health Organization in 2008. Probably some of you are aware of that, that report that came out. And he said at that time, social injustice is killing people on a grand scale. And I think we can certainly see that now. And what was recommended with the report is it's kind of a moral imperative that we do something about this. We don't just make a nod and say we recognize that, but we start changing social policies and move forward and make some real differences with that. So one other thing, perhaps, so it's one thing to go ahead and have these social policy changes, but we also need to make sure, as I've said before, that the healthcare practitioners are aware of those changes, involved in those changes, and they get to kind of see those policies in action.
So the Department of Health in 2010, kind of following on from the Lancet report somewhat, did an assessment of UK, you know, how are the healthcare practitioners doing here in terms of their training? How is the healthcare education doing? And what they found is many practitioners lack awareness, skills, and training to cope effectively with the most excluded. So now we're getting more into those socially excluded populations. So they've gone over the last few years to do more research around this, and once they recognized, yes, there's a gap, they wanted to figure out exactly what those gaps were. So some of you are probably aware of a report that just came out last month. It's from the National Inclusion Health Program. It came out in January 2016. Thank you for the Pathways team. I get their emails and I see this cool stuff. And what they found the gaps were, and by the way, they surveyed 89 HEIs. They surveyed tons, probably hundreds and hundreds of healthcare practitioners that work with these socially excluded populations, and they found the following gaps. They said inconsistent inclusion health education. Now, I think we are giving this education, but it's different at different universities or different HEIs. It's offered that, you know, some will have like your quality diversity. I think, you know, all of us that are practitioners have probably at least had 20 of those if you've been in the industry for more than 5 or 6 years. We get an awful lot of that. And so there's certain things that come up again that we get those trainings, but there's some other things that we're just not ticking the boxes with, or some will do a great job, other universities perhaps not quite so much. Limited academic expertise and inclusion health. What we tend to find sometimes in universities is you'll have fantastic researchers that will get up, do a presentation, and they have the knowledge, which is key. We've seen some, you know, great researchers today, yesterday, talking, and that's absolutely essential. But I think we also need to have people that have worked and lived, you know, these experiences to really speak to that and be like our, you know, experts by experience. I'm using that. I think that's fantastic. And so that's definitely something we need to be looking at. We need to make sure that academic staff members, that we invest in people that have worked in those environments, people that have worked with homeless populations. My background's mostly A&E and psych. So even though I find myself, you know, kind of lowly on the academic scale, I think hopefully I tick some boxes for experience. But it's really important that we don't just have academics working with the students on this. It needs to be people who have some real-world experience. Lack of opportunities for students to engage with the marginalized groups. So we're talking about, okay, you might see them perhaps in A&Es and secondary care settings, but how much experience are our students getting in where the patients live? Where our clients live out in the community, if they're homeless on the streets, how much opportunities are they getting to engage with them in their normal places that they would reside? Nursing is actually great for this, for community, lots of options to work with community organizations, specialized for urban care, particularly in America. I mean, I think it's the same here, but I think nursing's kind of done a real good job with that. But for medical students, that's not something that's offered extensively across the board. It's kind of done in different ways at different places. And one thing they really noticed was a problem was the absence of assessment. So they might have the occasional lectures, but they weren't specifically in the HEIs measuring those learning objectives to see if they were met. Lack of specialist training programs to help existing healthcare professionals. So this is more about sort of widening access. This is for the healthcare professionals that are out there, and not just my medical students that I work with or other students you might be working with. This is once the professionals are out there, are we giving them appropriate training? You know, do they have access to CPDs relevant to this field? And so that's something that the NAHP recommended be looked at as well. Excuse me. So recommendations. It's all kind of obvious when you see where they saw the gaps were, that the learning outcomes are demonstrated across their programs, and this is talking healthcare programs particularly, and that they are assessed, that the staff who are doing the training have some appropriate knowledge and skills, or if they don't, they get people with the appropriate knowledge and skills. They work closely with organizations that support those socially excluded groups, and they work with voluntary organizations. They involve the voluntary organizations in developing programs, being involved in the content that's being taught, and they widen access, particularly for CPD. So if they get this nailed, even in part, they get some great content, some great programs, that they look for opportunities to share that with the professionals that are already out there. So specific content, this isn't all of it, by the way. So what they did is they sort of combined some research, some real solid research, combined it with what the current HCPs are saying we need. this is what we need to be learning. And they came up with the things that balancing those two came up most often. It doesn't include everything. There are some appendices in the report that we'll talk about, some other things that healthcare professionals were asking for that isn't here. But what came up a lot was that mental health, substance misuse, health inequalities, understandably, safeguarding children and adults, social and economic determinants of health, homelessness, asylum seekers and refugees, exploitation, sexual exploitation of vulnerable groups, and the skills that promote patient engagement sounds a bit fuzzy, like what does that mean? So if you look further into the appendices, that's talking a bit more about how you can advance communication skills, how you can engage those groups, a little bit of motivational interviewing kind of thrown in there. There's a speaker who's speaking right now who I really wanted to go listen to. I think he's doing relational, who saw this? Relational something. Sounded good. I wanted to go.
Relational intelligence.
Thank you. Talking about self-care as well kind of ties into that, which I think is brilliant. So could be two places at once. That's okay. So the Durham University's Difficult and Deprived Areas program, that's what I manage. It started in 2013, so I came a little bit after it started in 2014. We are funded by Health Education Northeast. The original hook, if you like, is let's face it, you know, funding, there's often hooks as to why you're getting your funding. It was predominantly around recruitment and retention. Durham University sounds, you know, hoity-toity that we're in this lovely, you know, area. It was, you know, fairly wealthy, small section of Durham. But actually, the School of Medicine, Pharmacy, and Health is in Stockton and Middlesbrough, which is a very, very deprived part of the Northeast. So that's where we live. And so in that area, particularly, the recruitment and retention of GPs is a massive problem. So tied into that, you know, recruitment is one thing. So I thought, well, if we introduce, you know, fourth year medical students, we start talking about, you know, being GPs, and we give them the right skills, and we, you know, we nurture their altruism, which hasn't gone yet. By the time they finish after year five, a bit of it's knocked out of them, and we're trying to hold on to that altruism. But also, hand in hand with that, altruism only gets you so far. I mean, our burnout rates are, you know, incredibly high. We need to make sure they have the right skills, the appropriate skills, that they can handle things that are different than you would see in other populations. Good thing about, you know, our tri-morbidities, thinking about, you know, our plans of care are going to have to be customized to these groups. You can't just say, oh, we're going to give them this frontline antibiotic, when actually your second line one-time injection might be a lot more appropriate for a homeless person. So thinking about things like that, making sure that they're empathetic, and I think there's been several studies, again, I'm not a researcher, it says teaching fellow on my badge, and I'm quite proud that that's where I sit, but there's lots of research that's talking about how empathy can be kind of a protector against burnout. So I think really developing the empathy, in addition, it tends to make you work better with these populations, kind of push your bias out of the way, and you know, crack on and meet these people where they are. Expose them to the multidisciplinary and innovative models of care, and that's a couple of reasons. One, to make sure they know what resources are out there, they don't feel like they're working in isolation, which again can help perhaps with the stress. And also, they can be future innovators, you know, so they're going to come up with some creative models, hopefully in the future, that haven't yet been thought about, but we want to kind of nurture that and let them see some of the interesting things that are happening. So our program is 14 weeks, and that doesn't sound long, but in a medical program, you literally have to pry those weeks out of someone's dead hands. It's quite hard. I see people nodding in the room, right? Like, 14 weeks, how did you do
it? I have to manage all this angst. I have to manage all that angst.
You know what I'm talking about? 14 weeks is quite impressive. So we are, just to be clear, because I'm not sure if I've said this yet, Durham University does not have an independent medical school. We have our students for years 1 and 2, and then they feed into Newcastle University, who has them for years 3, 4, and 5. So we have to sort of be very nice and say to Newcastle University, we've done some research, and we think this longitudinal internship clerkship, which we heard all this stuff, but if we have one for longer, it has, you know, all these outcomes, and we can show the research that this stuff works, and it's fantastic. So please give us all of your SSEs, and that's how I'll explain this anyway, all of your self-selected components. We want them for a year. Well, of course, they said absolutely not. You're not getting them for that long. But we'll give you a self-selected component in their fourth year, in combination with their elective component. So in the fourth year, Newcastle medical students have a little bit of sort of lectures and stuff you start off with. Sorry, Kathy was my student last year. She's now fifth year. So they start off with some lectures and all come up Newcastle, and then they can sign up for a self-selected component. So this is, they have to do a self-selected component, but the content is kind of up to them. They go into this big database and they pick ones they like the look of. So they have one of those, I think it's about sort of what, the time to January. They have another one, I think like February to April, another one like April to June, and then they all go off to the far outreaches of Borneo or wherever it is they go for their elective. And we were told you can have the self-selected component three with the elective. So we do have a little bit of issues there because, you know, we have to convince them that they really want to be in Stockton, Middlesbrough and work on this program rather than go off to Borneo. But we have them for the SSC three and for the elective. That's 14 weeks. Of those 14 weeks, I have them the whole time, so they are mine for those 14 weeks. They do 2 days a week in community organization placements in deprived areas, in Stockton, Middlesbrough area. They get to change that up, so they have some options with that. They can say at the beginning what they're interested in. We have small groups. We only have typically 5 students a year, so this is small numbers. And so we can go ahead and usually no problem matching them up with what they're really interested in, and we break that up. So just because of where there's a little break that sits, they get 6 weeks at one and 8 weeks at another. The entire 14 weeks, they're placed at a local GP practice for 2 days a week, and that gives them a really nice clinical base. They will get involved in consultations. They can kind of feel like it's their little home for the 14 weeks, which is lovely. And then I have them half day a week in a classroom setting. And what we do in that half day, the format is typically, I start off with a bit of an introduction about topic, and I'll show you content in a moment. If it's something I'm genuinely an expert in, so there are, you know, a couple of things I can talk about, I will go ahead and give the presentation. If it is not something that I'm an expert in, and most of the time I really want community experts to come in and hopefully bring in an expert by experience with them, and I'm going to use that phrase, I love it, from now on I'm going to be using that. But I like them to bring someone in, and it, you know, so I'll go ahead and give the presentation. The lecture doesn't have to be formal like this. I know we're getting death by PowerPoint in the last few days, but you know, we try and have some sort of activity like that, and we'll have then an integrated activity at the end where they can sit together as a group and we can kind of work through some of those. We're trying to make that a bit more formal this year and really kind of formalize the end part of that. So the content is this. So we always start with an introduction to poverty and deprivation, commissioning, and I bring in a great commission in the area to come in and do that. Asylum seekers, refugees, substance misuse, mental health, and you can read what's up there. Sexual health, the ones with asterisks mean that I can't always get exactly that. So sexual health is every year. Sex workers are a difficult to access population. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Implicit bias, that may sound a bit flash. I mean, all that means is we've all done prejudice and bias, I think, at some point. Clinicians will typically cover that at some point. I'm trying to take this to a bit deeper a level, kind of going a little bit further with that. We all have bias, let's not pretend we don't. Let's try and figure out when we're triggered, try and do something with that. Conflict management. Now, like I said, a lot of my background is A&E, and so there is an aspect of that you don't want to get punched in the face because people have tried. I don't know, I'm lovely, I don't know why they want to, but apparently some people feel the urge to punch me. So there is a little bit of just keeping yourself safe, but more of that, I also want to talk about sort of verbal de-escalation. So this is where people are frustrated, which, you know, let's face it, understandably, some of these populations are frustrated, and if you're starting to see cues early on, it's about how you catch that, what you deal with that. So maybe like power, you know, people would get into power struggles if we're not careful. So we look at some of that. So some of these skills that we felt needed to be put in there, these workshops. We're adding, this is new, clinician stress management self-care. That's why I wanted to go to the other session a little bit. That was based on students saying, we need more of that. You know, why don't you give us more of that? So that's going to be new this year. And motivational interviewing. Last year, our speaker couldn't speak. We've had that most years. And so assessment, how we assess is the students have learning portfolios. And what these are, if you're a medical student, and apparently you start at age, you know, 3 and you have until you're 100, and you just, these are like for all of your training, you have these learning portfolios. But they'll have learning objectives for the course, so sort of some standard learning objectives that I've set up in advance. And then the students customize early on, so they have very strong interest in homelessness medicine. They might customize some of their learning objectives as well. These are plugged into this learning portfolio. And early on, they're kind of guided to come up with how exactly is it you're going to get those learning objectives. We kind of empower students to some degree, but then I guide them and we talk through it. So sometimes it might mean it could be things that could be assessed by me speaking to the community supervisor or the GP and say, you know, are you observing that? Does it look like they're meeting those objectives? Sometimes it would be met by them having to do a reflective piece of writing to really sort of say they've explored this and they've thought about it, they've maybe done a little bit of research, this is what they've come up with. And if it's really just content-based, sometimes the best way to assess that is a presentation that's graded. So these all end up really in the learning portfolio, but it has to be clear up front how it is that they're going to be able to meet those learning objectives. Something new, and I just feel like this, it happened organically, but I think we're going to slightly more formally make sure that they start looking at identifying a public health problem and trying to come up with a solution. So that's something we'll be bringing in. And at the end, they just sort of do a little report about their experience, and they have to do a massive survey to help me make the program better. So that's all. Something that's really popular, and it seems to be very, very useful, is the London field trip. So that started in 2014. First year I came in, I just felt that this was, you know, something that would be really, really helpful for the students to come into another city environment, try and look for where there were some, you know, really innovative models, things that, you know, maybe the students hadn't been exposed to, might not get to see. And so we worked with St. Mungo's. I don't know if there's someone here. I know there's someone here with St. Mungo's in there. So we worked with St. Mungo's. Head of Learning Development, Peter Coley, helped us set up 3 days of activities. And you know, we were in hostels, different kinds of hostels, different populations, older gentlemen with drinking histories, to much more integrated men and women with, you know, a myriad of issues, substance misuse, things like that. There's groups that were, you know, focused on that. We went to No Second Night Out, which was really interesting. It's just trying to make sure that people that are newly homeless don't stay homeless, and kind of had a, it's kind of like an emergency triage for, you know, new homeless people. And we met with the Pathways team at UCH, and that was actually very, very popular with our students. We got to sit in when they did reports and listen to the, you know, the different team members that were working with them. We met the street med and the HDM team, the sort of discharge network, that have the beds that the Pathways team can access. So we kind of got to see, and then we did outreach, by the way, I won't forget that, but night outreach. That was really popular. The students were out till about 2 a.m. under bridges with flashlights and things like that, and that's a very popular part of the program. And then we did end up in a fantastic hostel called Mare Street, which is connected to Greenhouse, which is a specialized GP practice in homelessness. So combined with all of this, I just felt like this is around homelessness predominantly, which is not what the entire program is about. They got to see all these different things that are kind of intersecting and working together in some innovative ways of practice. So feedback, this is, again, I'm not a researcher, this is mostly from surveys, it's you know, qualitative data, and 100% of the students felt that they had now an increased awareness of how to practice medicine in difficult to deprived areas. 100% thought the content was quite stimulating and motivational, and they felt that it met the learning objectives. 100% liked the overall experience of London field trip, again, that was very popular. And they unanimously agreed that having been exposed to all of those different things made them not only better professionals, but better people. We did have a funded research over the first 2 years. If you want to see something a bit more, you know, research heavy, got some good stats and numbers, it is qualitative still, but he conducted, Dr. Paul Crampton conducted over 100 interviews, and he found that, again, kind of what I got a little bit there, but that they felt more knowledgeable about psychosocial determinants of health, they felt that it promoted and developed their compassion, reinforced their clinical skills, promoted deeper learning about the role of a doctor, and it gave them an understanding of how to care for patients with complex needs. So one of the other things they mentioned in the NIHP report was sharing practice, talking to other organizations, can we share some of this content? I am not private about my stuff. Maybe that sounded really inappropriate. I mean, professionally, and maybe some other stuff too, but I am not that private about this. If people want to know what we're doing, if they want to know what the content is, if they have questions, we are like, yeah, no problem at all. So we've been talking to a couple of international universities about what we do. I'll be going to York Hull shortly. Met someone from Imperial College yesterday that I'd love to speak to. But you know, I'm thrilled to talk to anyone about what we're doing. I don't think that we corner the market on this. I mean, there's some other fantastic things going on around this, so I can equally learn from people as well as sharing. So anyone's welcome to contact me. And in conclusion, basically, you know, we're making headway, but there's still an awful lot to be done. And I'm going to make this more robust. Thank you very much. I'm going to hand over to we're going to do questions at the end because there's going to be quite a bit of overlap. And again, I have Kath Brownridge here. She's now a PhD medical student, so I wanted to ask about a student perspective of being in the program. Thank you.
But Suzanne, look.
Oh, you want me to get out of it? I can show you.
I can do it.
My husband would not believe I was doing this. Like, someone was asking me to fix this. He'd be like, no.
I had a wonderful trip to Brighton. Has everybody here been to Brighton? What a lovely city. I was slightly stunned. I walked from the train station down to the front to the conference centre, and I was literally stepping over homeless people, lying, snoozing in the sun. I have never seen so many homeless people just sort of in one street. It's a big problem.
Quite a lot of people from Brighton here.
Are there? Uh-huh.
Aren't you able to do that?
I am. Give me the nod.
Yes. So, thank you, Suzanne. My name is Chris Sargent. I'm the GP with Pathway Team down in Brighton, and also part-time senior clinical lecturer at Brighton Assessive Medical School. So I've been asked to talk to you about a sort of general overview, really, of what we're trying to do for the faculty of Pathway in terms of education and training. So I'll keep it fairly unaware. This is the last session on the last day and all of that, so I'll keep it fairly broad and fairly light, and then anything you want to talk about, we'll talk about any questions afterwards. So general themes. Obviously the most important thing is that we have a strong expert experience influence in all of the education that we do. I think over the past couple of years it's been obvious that that's where our focus needs to be, that's where everything needs to be coming from. We're multi-professional, so we all learn together, as we are doing at the moment, and as we do on CPD days. Anybody can come along to those. You don't have to be a doctor, you don't have to be a nurse. On the other hand, you don't have to be a community service either. Everyone come and learn together. And it's interprofessional learning, so that means that we learn from each other, and that we believe that everybody has something to contribute, and we can all learn from each other. We're inclusive and collaborative, and we take all the opportunities that we can in terms of educating people and training people. So we're not going to exclude people. Anytime an opportunity comes up, we'll generally say yes. If we can't do it today, we'll try and do it tomorrow. And this is at all levels of profession. So people in training up to consultant level, if you're talking about medicine. Also, I should have put on there reflective. So reflective practice is a large part of what we're trying to do. We have a reflective practice group once a month down in Brighton, which a large number of people come to. And again, that's people from all parts of the service. So our outreach workers come to that, our nurses come to that, physios, OTs, doctors, everyone's invited. So in terms of training, we take the opportunities that we can to educate people on an individual and group basis. So in terms of our team pathway, we will take any student really that brings us up and says, can I come and spend time with you? It's often colleagues who end up showing them around, so people like Simon, who's sitting in the second row here, we'll have had people with lots of medical students, but we have lots of nursing students, we have physio students, OT, we have police on their probationary period coming to the end of that. Anybody else basically who wants to. We've had nurses on electives come to us, medical students on electives as well, which we send other people down. We also take opportunities to talk to other groups of people, so we'll talk to junior doctors groups, student groups. We'll do a grand round one day. I know some of the other teams have done grand rounds in the past, so for the whole of the medical fraternity at the hospital. We'll talk to CCG members, we'll go to CCG boards, CCG meetings, everyone to try and raise the profile of what we're trying to do. We'll talk to colleagues from the different professions that we deal with, so housing, local government, adult social care. Again, we'll have social work students with us to see what we're doing. I don't think that's ever wasted effort. It's always a good thing to have somebody coming and learning with you, and again, going off and learning from them too. We also have special interest groups. So I know a lot of the other hospitals have this too. So the A&E frequent attenders meetings. So we'll meet with people from A&E, other parts of the hospital, people from the community, ourselves, talking about particular patients and whether there's anything that we can do more for them. We obviously have our regular multidisciplinary meeting as well, at which we invite a wide range of people to talk on a sort of patient focus. Other things that are developing are we're developing an online training for the Royal College of Emergency Medicine to put onto their website using video interviews, sort of question and answer format about inclusion health, about what do you do when the man with alcohol dependence who's always coming into the hospital comes in with a setting of fit, how do you, you know, where do you take it from there? Rather than patching up, sending them out and again 2 days later, how can we sort of make some progress? How can we make some links between the hospital and community services? Which I think is what a lot of pathway teams do, is sort of breaking down that divide between the hospital and primary care services and other community services. We're also working with Public Health England, using materials developed from this conference, so some of the video that's been taken of the talks, to put those into packages and modules that people can look at online. Things that we do locally, so CPD, continuing professional development. So again, that's done at all different sorts of levels. We have the locally organised pathway meetings, which increasingly there are more and more of those as we go along. So the one we have locally is the South Coast one, and there are also the special interest groups which are developing. So there's a mental health group which has been going for about a year, I think, and I think there's an OT group that's just started recently. There are the national and regional CPD days. So, sorry, that should be King's Health Partners, not UKT, but they have a monthly CPD offering, which is organised by Zana Khan. And in Brighton, we've had the Brighton University CPD days once a year for the last 2 years. The next one will be in September. I'll be organising that. Hopefully that will be in Leicester this year, so that everyone who can't make it down from up north down to Brighton will be able to make it halfway down to Leicester, and we'll go meet halfway. Again, the expert by experience influence is very strong. At the last CPD day, we were very lucky that each session had someone presenting from a professional point of view, and then an expert by experience talking about their experience from an expert by experience point of view. And I think that gives, A, it gives a different flavour to what people are saying, and B, I think the learning is much richer if you're hearing both sides of the story or where the stories come together. The CPD days also provide fantastic networking, support and inspiration. An example of that is that in Brighton now we're in the process of starting a new community interest company directly as a result of hearing Anna Hyde from Leicester come and talk to us at the CPD day. So that's a direct result of something that happened at one of the CPD days. So it's great, the education is fantastic, it's lovely to meet everybody, the kind of real things can come out of it, so really important things. In terms of undergraduate teaching, I've heard a lot from Suzanne already, but influencing the next generation, so there's lots of opportunities to do that. From the medical student point of view, they can come and shadow, just by seeing what other people do all day, it can be a big eye-opener for undergraduates. So what we do in the surgery, what we do in the ward, what we do in the community, we do teaching as part of the GP module, and I know a lot of people will be doing that already, the people in the room, but I think if you're not doing that, don't be worried about approaching your local medical school and offering. As we heard, I think the report said that it was about 50% of institutions have someone who's got some experience in the inclusion health field, which obviously means that half of them haven't. So we've got a 50-50 chance if you approach them, they'll be one of the ones that haven't. We also, in Brighton, do teaching about discharging homeless people from hospital as part of the infectious disease rotation. So we have groups of 20 students at a time. And again, it's something that, for obvious reasons, undergraduates basically haven't thought about the difficulties, A, of discharging people as any sort of problem, particularly if there's no way to discharge them too. So they seem to get a lot out of that too. I also teach a special study component, not as developed as yours. We have 7 weeks, which we have 4 weeks sort of on site, 3 weeks out to visits. We try and do one primary care, one secondary care, one community visit in there. Again, I think some of the students find that very inspiring. Also try and support what the students are doing themselves. So Rose, who's also sitting in the second row, is part of the Student Homelessness Society. So they organised an event a couple of weeks ago, which we all supported to go talk to the students who are interested in our volunteering opportunities in the homelessness world. And then in terms of research, again, we take the opportunities that we can really, so large and small research projects. There's a recently announced research into the outcomes from the Pathway team, and certainly the Brighton team and the Royal London team both sort of grew out of research projects, supporting others in turn who are trying to research aspects of our work. So we have medical students who do their individual research projects, so we're trying to support them. You should have one or two of those of you doing something around homelessness. They always need supervisors, so somebody's done one recently on trimorbidity in the GP service. Somebody else has one about the problems of transferring from prison medical records. And then at sort of slightly higher level, we can support MSc students doing their research. Often public health students need supervisors. Well, we have one who did one into end of life care in hospital setting, which was very interesting and very worthwhile.
Oh, sorry. I'm still reading it.
So,
yeah, it was a good slide.
So, where is all this taking us? So, we have plans, as some of you will know from last year, for progressing to the postgraduate qualification. So, postgraduate certificate in inclusion health, and we're at the moment busy talking to lots of different institutions about who might be able to take that on, whether that would fit in as a sort of standalone thing that could then be built on towards a higher qualification, such as an MSc, but it could be part of some other MSc, such as a public health one. So we're discussing with Middlesex, the discussions going on with UCL at the moment as well. What we'd ideally like to do with the EBE influence is to try and have a course which goes alongside EBE's learning, perhaps for a different qualification, but learning together with different outcomes. So there's nothing saying you can't all be in the same room, learning the same thing, but then obviously depending on your educational background, you could be looking for a different qualification in the end. Because I think we need to recognise and develop that advocacy and support role that EBEs can do, and provide sort of a professional and personal development role for the EBEs too. And all of that's overseen by the Faculty Education Committee. So I think in terms of getting involved, if you're not already, and I know a lot of you already are, think about organising your own local CPD sessions. Support all the opportunities you can for teaching, training and research. Don't be scared to approach people and offer. Worst thing you can do is say no. Support the regional and national CPD events, because they're well worth attending. And consider coming along to the appropriate courses when we've got them ready.
For the two medical students who kindly come, just... do you want to stand up and just say 1 minute each what you thought was brilliant, or can you do that? What about your training, your course in homelessness?
So, I have to pay her. I have to like buy her lots of chocolate.
So
I didn't know this was going to happen.
I did the Difficult Deprived Areas project last summer, and I don't know really what you want to know.
Was it brilliant? Do you
it
benefit?
Brilliant.
Should all students do it?
All students should do it.
Should it start in schools? This is what I'm wondering.
In school rather than medical school.
I don't know.
Social
I think
injustice. Maybe. I think the nice thing about doing it at the end of fourth year is you've done a lot of clinical stuff already, and you can kind of look at it in a slightly more sort of experienced view. I don't know. You can kind of reflect on it a lot more and learn a lot more, I think, than if you're in school.
And you've got a question.
So, a question
yes.
for you, Kat.
Yeah.
So if you could maybe, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but if you could maybe think of one thing that has done to change your future practice as a doctor, what would that be?
I think probably just thinking more holistically, but sort of wider sort of view on somebody, and sort of thinking more about other things that are impacting on them and their life and their, not just their health, I guess. That probably, yeah. But for me, like, I never really had something that really sort of sold to me in medicine, and then that kind of tells the first thing.
Thank you. No, is it Brighton? Is there anything you want to say? Tell us about the student volunteering.
Co-run the Homeless Medicine Society, and that's trying to get other medical students involved, and Chris has helped with that. So that's a way that other medical students can do the ward rounds with Chris and get involved with volunteering and things. I also do my GP placement is with Tim, a homeless GP, which is fantastic for me. And we just had to do a GP report, which is reflecting on our experience working with that and how it's kind of changed our practice. And then I also did 3 months for my elective in Boston with this program.
Oh, yes.
So I was
that's Dean Wiley.
Jim O'Connolly.
Oh, yeah.
He spoke here before.
Brilliant.
That's how I got onto it. and that was fantastic. So that was street outreach, but and going into the community. I think there's been lots of opportunities for me. I also go around with Pathway.
Fantastic.
It's just changed how I think about medicine, because we're always taught like to go by so many conventions of like, but actually when you're dealing with the homeless people, you so have to go with the flow and meet them on their level, and that on the street outreach we'd often be like really bad handing out cigarettes to people so that they would come with us to hospital, because actually what's going to kill them is not the cigarette, it's not being in hospital.
Well, it looks like we've got a good future here with our medics. So, what have we got? Some questions? One, any more? Two, three, four. So, one, two, three, four. Is that okay? I've just got a very quick one now. I'm going to be mean and just ask it. It's fantastic, and you know, I've been trying to get Bristol, which is my local medical school, to all this. Are we going to help home? Are we actually going to reduce homelessness with this education? They're going to get a much better deal with this education. Are we actually going to reduce homelessness? Because that's really what we want to do. And
yeah.
I'm just being a bit of a devil's advocate.
Yeah, I think if people know the system, I think that's the difference with having the pathway team. So if you have more people who know the system and how to make the system work as well as it possibly can, then you will have fewer people homeless. There are fewer people who are homeless who leave the hospital now than there were before the pathway team came in. The system is the same. The same opportunity, the council have the same criteria, so nothing's changed there. So I think yes, it will.
Brilliant.
Because people will know how the system works better.
Yeah.
And they'll know the type of information that's needed. So as we talk about how you give information to somebody in the housing department,
yeah,
who's not medically trained,
yeah,
to make sort of flag up to them that this person is a priority for housing. So I think all those sort of things you can learn that.
Fantastic.
We talk a lot about that with the students.
And I was going to say much the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, the students get to learn the different resources so they can plug into those and catch people fairly early on. But I also think there's a lot around building that trusting relationship that can help these excluded populations re-engage that might then lead to them, you know, being able to come into more mainstream settings and out of homelessness. So.
Okay.
Just follow that up with one comment.
Okay.
Sorry. For a long time I was running homeless teaching in Southampton Medical School there.
Right.
What I used to say to students was, not just you're learning about homelessness, but actually I think the skills that they learn make them better doctors.
I agree.
Yes, there's something about inclusion health and reducing homelessness in the future, but actually I think it's that, just being a good medic. So, you know, I think it's too important.
I'm sorry, this is all a bit doctor-bass, isn't it? I'm sorry. But I'm sure it's relevant to all healthcare professionals.
Absolutely.
And you teach everyone, don't you?
Yeah.
Right, number one.
I'm not sure if this is going quite as a question or a statement, but yeah, I'm a medical student as well. Sorry. So I'm currently I also run the university's Women's Society from Warwick, and I've just recently like set up a winter night shelter in London.
Goodness,
that's
brilliant.
Thank you. So it's just something that I really, really care about. I'm going to be doing my elective in Pathway next year as well. And so far at university we've had one lecture on homelessness and health and one lecture on migrant health. And I personally just find that to do anything I have to work quite hard at finding the information out for myself. I'm dying to do some research and I'm finding that so hard to come across. I've emailed the hospitals I'm based at and gotten nowhere. And I just think perhaps there needs to be more of a identifiable body or source of information for people who do want to get into homeless medicine, because I'm dying to just qualify and get stuck in.
And one thing you three could do is perhaps get together and if you did a little audit, Shane, students in these two unis do a lot better than students in your uni.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have a collaborative audit that would highlight core skills and deals. Is that something they could do? Is there anything else you can do to help Warwick get their act together? And Gloucester, Bristol, Southampton.
It's trying to raise a profile, isn't it?
Gloucester.
It's trying to raise a profile, so it's the report that Suzanne was talking about has a lot in there about what, you know, what should be being done, how training should be being done. So I guess that needs to go to the right person to have a look at, so they can think about what more they could do.
Could they invite you two, one of you two?
Absolutely.
I'd all
you
be
said
happy
you
to be invited.
I'll go wherever people ask me to. I'm pretty easygoing. Wherever you want me.
It is difficult, a bit like Suzanne was saying before, that, you know, to have all that time in the curriculum, and we have a little bit more than that, but not a great deal more. And it may be that you need to ask for the student selected component for there to be one in homelessness, because that's a fairly easy thing to get first, and that can sort of be the wedge that you can then move things on from there.
There needs to be sort of big, and I think I'm hoping Tim's actually going to say what I'm leading to, but then there needs to be some just big policy shifts. I mean, I think it's really quite surprising that you've got the Royal College of Physicians are interested in homelessness medicine, and that the Royal College of GPs are not. And so it's like, I think they just, you need to all together raise the profile of this, and it needs to be, you know, yelled to the rafters in bigger environments. But go ahead, Tim. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well, what I've heard him say is there's a huge amount of research and data out there, but it's not, people don't know how to access it. So
yeah,
it would be really good if we actually got it all placed with it. There's loads of papers. I was really staggered when I did some stuff in Oxford, you know, just how much there is. But I don't know.
Facilities on the pathway website to make that happen. So I'm happy with pathway, people with the faculty. And actually, the second or third person across these 2 days who said, medical students need to help with
these
kind of issues, and I'm wondering if they make space for the faculty.
Yeah, definitely.
I need to
something
email
we should be doing.
Bristol.
Yeah.
I'm going to email Bristol where they have nothing with Suzanne's detail. Okay, number two, quick, we've only got 5 minutes, so I've been given the warning. Who's number two?
Was I number two or three?
I think
me
two.
Oh, okay. Martin Cleveland's Buxton University, and actually I was one of the advisors on the report Suzanne's been speaking about, a lot of teaching with nurses and medical students. So, first of all, I also want to put a plug in and say that we actually get a lot of people out, so I get people come out with me who are social workers and nurses, and they come and do research and things as well, real hands-on. But one of the things I'm interested in is actually exploring how much you found this work to be ghetto-wise, because certainly in my experience, I go and talk to people and I go, it's fabulous to have you here, but people talk about feeling very isolated in their work, their colleagues, fellow students, fellow practitioners, sort of go, actually that's a bit nasty, I don't want to get my hands dirty and be involved. And does that sort of resonate with you as well? Anyone really?
I think that's what Pathway's for largely, isn't it? Is that the sort of CPD and continuing education events are to try and counteract that. Because I think, yes, I mean, I think if so I started the GP surgery in Brighton sort of day one as a new person to the area and felt very sort of excluded from the rest of the general practice in the area. They were like, great, you're here, fine, carry on with that. We don't want anything to do with it. So certainly that's true. I think it's less true now, I think since Pathway came along, and I think certainly as far as the medical school in Brighton goes, it is seen as an important thing for students to learn about. The infectious diseases people came to us to ask us to do something about discharging homeless people. So I think it's changing, but that may be because of the locality that I'm in rather than as a general thing. But yeah, that's always it's always the risk.
And is there mileage in terms of having this sort of compulsory unit, generally this inclusion of health within medical
I think so. Absolutely. I think so.
Absolutely.
I think if you have people who volunteer to do it, that's great. But in a way, you're teaching slightly to converted, because I know Rose was involved with homelessness before she came to medical school. But to get the people who aren't really interested is the important thing as well, so that everybody has a certain level of knowledge.
Absolutely. These are the students that need it less.
Number three.
That's actually the second point there. I answered my question, which was you're getting a self-selected group of students for SSEs and electives, and how you could get it more integrated into the broader curriculum and medical school.
Plugging away.
It keeps coming back to the prying out of dead cold hands kind of issue.
That
you just got to fight for that.
Just put it in the exams, and then people soon learn about it.
Yeah,
every time. So
So how did you get into the? I'm Heidegger. I'm part time a mainstream GP and part-time in the homeless services. So, and we had two students who chose to do their electives with us. So that was great news, and one of them is coming back now. That's great news too. We always have pockets, people coming who have got an interest. I've got always somebody sitting, and I'm doing the VTS day teaching. But I don't do anything at the medical school. For me, the question one would be, where would a lecture, within what year or time would a lecture best sit in, and how do you approach it?
Mm-hmm. I do mine in the GP rotation in the fourth year, so it's about general practice and homelessness and exclusion.
I mean, we have got a PBL,
BPD,
and practice-based learning. So they are in GP practice from the first year. So that it's more like subject related. So
yeah, we do quite a bit in.
So there isn't a general practice
sure.
module.
So infectious diseases.
So it would be it wouldn't sit in mental health quite. So although people then come when they do like addiction and mental health, there is some groups choose to have an attachment with us, but there isn't. So it would be a question, when is the, you can answer it.
Well, we start as early
where,
as the the first year. Like
our
first year medical students actually do, they do personal professional development strand, but they also do medicine in the community. So they're doing 6-month community placements, bridging from first year to second year. So we're getting them quite early, and that's a required, all of the students are doing that. And so we've got it there as a requirement, and actually we're now being approached by Foundation School, we're talking to Foundation School and VTS about being required there. Just ironically is where I am teaching it at the moment. I'm not getting a lot of leverage about making it required there, and I think it's just because there's so many people fighting for that time, for that content. It's quite tricky.
So can I just comment? So for me, I think what you need is you need to find your champions.
Mm-hmm.
And in different universities, they're going to be in different places. So sometimes it's the social scientist, so you might have a sociologist who has got an interest in exclusion and stigma and so on, and you can slot in there. Sometimes it's infectious diseases, sometimes it's addiction. And I think, because it is marginalised, in homelessness,
it doesn't fit any of the categories.
You're not
popular
a clinician if you're involved with homelessness. So you just have to find an ally, get a foot in the door, and then build it from there. That's my experience.
Okay, thank you. I think that's it. Any more? We can have one more? Oh, should we go and have tea for the last session of the afternoon? Thank you, and thank you. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. But yeah, I was just emotional about yours in terms of like everybody is just what's happening with your CPD stuff.
Yeah.
So I actually have to get your email because I mean you're on the list.
I mean, the other thing we could do is think about doing something else.